This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy B. The World Health Organization says 184 countries have now joined the COVID-19 Global Vaccine Alliance, known as COVAX, designed to speed development and distribution of an eventual COVID-19 vaccine. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Monday that Ecuador and Uruguay are the most recent nations to join the cooperative program. The United States is not part of the COVAX program, calling it too constraining. Earlier this year, the Trump administration said it was withdrawing support for WHO, saying the group is too heavily influenced by China. U.S. President Donald Trump has blamed China for the global spread of the disease. China announced last month that it is joining COVAX program. Tedros said that as the virus spreads in Europe and other parts of the world, sharing resources, supplies can help save lives. U.S. lawmakers are running out of time to pass a second massive round of aid addressing the economic and health crisis caused by the coronavirus. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was to talk with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin Monday ahead of a self-imposed 48-hour deadline to reach a deal before Election Day on November 3rd. If the White House and Democratic majority House of Representatives cannot reach an agreement by Tuesday, the next opportunity for negotiations on aid will come during a lame duck session of Congress in November and December. On Sunday, Speaker Pelosi told ABC's This Week Sunday news program that the Trump administration had removed key language from the legislation that laid out testing and tracing strategies. U.S. lawmakers have repeatedly failed to reach an agreement on a second round of economic aid to millions of Americans impacted by the pandemic. In September, Senate Republicans failed to pass a slimmed-down $500 billion aid proposal. This is VOA News. U.S. President Donald Trump announced Monday the United States would remove Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism as soon as Khartoum sets aside the $335 million it had agreed to pay to American victims of militant attacks and their families. A U.S. official told Reuters that the deal could also set in motion steps by Sudan toward establishing diplomatic relations with Israel, following similar moves by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Sudan's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism was established in the 1990s during the presidency of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir, who was deposed last year. The designation has since made it difficult for Sudan's transitional government to access debt relief and foreign financing. Many in Sudan say the designation imposed in 1993 because Washington believed Bashir was supporting militant groups has become outdated since he was removed last year, and Sudan has long cooperated on counterterrorism. A new report from Human Rights Watch says that North Korea's pretrial detention system is characterized by systemic torture, degrading treatment, and rampant corruption. The New York-based group discussed the secretive country's criminal justice system in an 88-page report released Monday. The report is based on accounts by former detainees as well as former government officials who fled the country. Former detainees said they were forced to sit still on the floor for days, facing punishment if they moved. Prisoners were also subjected to collective punishment. If one person broke a rule, all detainees in the cell were punished as well. Some female detainees reported sexual harassment and assault, including rape. Brad Adams, the Human Rights Watch Asia director, called North Korea's pretrial detention system arbitrary, violent, cruel, and degrading. There has been no comment from Pyongyang, and the North Korean government has repeatedly denied committing human rights abuses. The report was based on interviews with 8 former North Korean government officials who fled the country and 22 former detainees, 15 women and 7 men, all who were in detention after 2011 when current leader Kim Jong-un took power. The U.S. Supreme Court Monday declined to hear a challenge to a decision by the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court allowing the counting of mail-in absentee ballots up to 3 days past Election Day, as long as they are postmarked by Election Day, which is November 3rd. The decision favored Pennsylvania Democrats, who had sought the extension against the objections of Pennsylvania Republicans. Chief Justice John Roberts sided with the court's 3 liberal justices and declining to hear the case, signaling that the U.S. Supreme Court still considers itself independent of partisan politics. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, the VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinea's main opposition candidate claims early victory in Sunday's vote.
The numbers that we are seeing today, it looks like Selu will win on the first round. All over the countries and even the party in power strongholds, Selu Dalein Diallo is winning massively.
Uganda's main opposition party announces a strong campaign team ahead of the 2021 election. Boko Haram attacks make Cameroon's northern border schools unsafe. Malawi's president commits to protecting the environment, and protests continue in Nigeria despite concessions to reform the police.
The president and the minister of information are the anarchists, and they are the ones causing trouble in the country. They are the ones who have refused to do the things that they need to do, and they are the ones who have unleashed hoodlums on protesters.
And the economic benefits of preserving trees in Malawi. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Guinea, a top advisor to main opposition leader Selu Dalein Diallo is calling on the international community to ensure incumbent President Alpha Condé respects the wishes of the people by accepting the results of the election. Fiano Diallo says preliminary results so far show the main opposition leader will defeat President Condé. His remarks come as the Electoral Commission is tabulating results from Sunday's election. A presidential candidate must win over 50% of the total vote cast to be declared the winner. Supporters of incumbent President Alpha Condé remain confident that he will win re-election. Fiano Diallo tells VOA's Peter Clotty that based on the preliminary results that the party has compiled, the opposition is confident that Mr. Diallo will win.
As the counting continues, we are looking at the trends of the numbers. Our observers are still monitoring the situation on the ground. But the numbers that we are seeing today, it looks like Selu will win on the first round. All over the countries and even the party in power's strongholds, Selu Dalein Diallo is winning massively. So it looks like he will win on the first round, which means that he's going to have a majority of at least 50.1% to be the next president of the Republic of Guinea.
When does the Electoral Commission plan to announce the final results of the election?
Technically, they should be able to announce at least temporary results as of the end of the day today. But they have a few days to answer any irregularities or any issues they have to pronounce a number. Yesterday, the director of the campaign for the president, also prime minister, says they have 7 days, but technically they don't need 7 days to declare it. It is important that this time they respect the will of the population of Guinea, because if you know, in 2010 and 2015, we endured really rich, unfair and unfree elections. And Selu Dalein back then putting the interests of peace and the interests of Guinea and accepted those results. But this will not be possible this time if the will of the population of Guinea is to elect Selu Dalein Diallo as a president.
Some people are expressing concern that perhaps the figures that you are seeing might not necessarily be the same figures that the Electoral Commission might announce. So how do you resolve this if there is a problem with the figures you are seeing and what the Electoral Commission announces?
Well, the figure we are seeing are coming from the Bureau of Vote, because we are doing the counting as it is today. But ahead of today, we had a significant concern about the process, particularly because the result is not being given to all political parties. We have that concern and that worry. But the numbers that I'm giving you right now are numbers that are coming from the tallying of each polling station. So let's wait and see what the CENI will bring. But however, we have a comparative data to argue from. And we expect at least the CENI this time to respect the will of the population.
So you are expecting both the CENI, the Electoral Commission, and the president to respect the will of the people. Is that what you are saying?
Exactly. This is what we are saying. And this time around, we expect the will of the population of Guinea to be respected. Especially should Selu Dalein emerge as a winner, we expect that, and we expect also regional and international partners should work with the President Condé to ensure the will of the people are respected and they should facilitate the transition of power.
Thiano Diallo is a top advisor to the campaign team of main opposition leader Selu Daling Diallo of Guinea. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from Conakry. Protests continue Monday in Nigeria, calling for the dissolution of the police special anti-robbery squad known as SARS because of alleged human rights abuses. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari Monday said the protesters have the constitutional right to demonstrate. However, he cautioned them to be mindful of anarchists who, he said, might want to hijack the movement. The police have also called on the protesters to end their protest and to enter into a dialogue. Aisha Yesufu is an activist Nigerian citizen.
Police brutality shouldn't be, and extrajudicial killing is wrong. Citizens being extorted by police, being named, being harassed, being arrested when they haven't done anything wrong, is absolutely wrong. And so for me, anything that has to do with fighting against injustice, I will always support it. When they came out to protest, the police had attacked them, and I came out the following day to be with them.
I'm sure you know the president, President Buhari, and even the Minister of Information of Nigeria, they think that the protest has been infiltrated by anarchists who are bent on causing trouble for the country.
Well, the president and the minister of information are the anarchists, and they are the ones causing trouble in the country. They are the ones who have refused to do the things that they need to do, and they are the ones who have unleashed hoodlums on protesters rather than doing the needful. The president unleashed our military on us when we went to the National Assembly. Even today, the streets of Nigeria had military men of Abuja. Military were deployed. Soldiers have been used to attack the protesters. And I think if there's anybody who is behaving unlawfully, unconstitutionally, is the president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, Muhammadu Buhari himself.
I had a chance to speak on my program with the spokesperson for the Nigerian Army, Colonel Sergei Musa. And he mentioned something about this Operation Crocodile Smile. He said it had nothing to do with the protest. It was just an annual thing. What do Nigerians think about the military exercises?
Well, the thing Nigerians think about them is that the military should just be ashamed of themselves. They have turned themselves into puppets. They've not realized that their allegiance is to Nigeria and the Nigerian people and not to the president and the ruling party. They are supposed to uphold the constitution and not to be the ones that will go against the constitution. Protest is allowed. Why is it that all of a sudden they have this Operation Crocodile Tears where they are doing cyber war and they're all over checking who they claim are going to unsettle the country? Meanwhile, Boko Haram have been dealing with them. Boko Haram have been dealing with the country. They haven't provided strategic leadership for the soldiers to be able to defeat Boko Haram terrorist groups and the bandits.
As you know, the police, they have disbanded this SARS, and the police, I think, are willing to undergo training. Would that be enough?
If they disbanded SARS in 2017, was that enough? No, it wasn't enough, because we have a situation whereby the government and the police say one thing and they do absolutely another. We've had in the last, when they say they accepted the demands, they're going to work on it. As I speak to you now, police are still on the street. They are still harassing people. They are still maiming people. They are still killing people. Protesters have been killed. And in the last few days, every day, protesters have been killed. So you figure, where is the trust? How do the protesters trust them when in the midst of this thing that they are going to, they've accepted the demands, are going to work on it, and yet protesters are being killed, protesters are being harassed. One of the demands is that all protesters that have been arrested should be released.
Aisha Yesufu is an active Nigerian citizen. She was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, has launched what it calls a strong campaign team ahead of the 2021 elections. FDC head Patrick Oboy Amuriat says the team will be composed of over 2.5 million party supporters who will canvass for votes across the country. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala.
Speaking at the launch of the national campaign team in Kampala this Monday, Amuriat said FDC party has devised small village teams that will reach out small groups and households across the nation without breaching the COVID-19 guidelines.
The team that has been unveiled is no ordinary team. It's a team that has been prepared over the years to carry out such tasks that would bring glory to the FDC, And therefore, the team being unveiled to Ugandans is a team that is going to go into the campaign knowing that they are going to face a dictator, and therefore we go into the campaign in a war formation.
Uganda's Electoral Commission issued an electoral roadmap asking those seeking votes to campaign virtually as a way to curtail the spread of COVID-19. But at times, politicians, especially from the ruling government, have conducted rallies and meetings.
This team will be responsible for encouraging our supporters who may have lost confidence in the kind of campaign that we are going into on account of what happened in the past to go out to vote. They will also have the responsibility of protecting the vote and also protecting our victory. Like we have said before, this is not going to be business as usual. You push us, we push you back. You hit us, we hit you.
Deus Mukala Zimubiru, a senior research associate at Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies, a Kampala-based think tank, says musician turned politician Robert Chagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, will eat into FDC's traditional support.
I would imagine that's a questionable number, seeing that in the 2016 elections, there was quite a number of polling stations that went without agents for the FDC party. I know that the opposition in Uganda has been dominated by FDC. The emergence of the National Unity Platform is something that really changes the dynamics, and it waits to be seen how FDC will try and survive within these waters.
Lawyer and political commentator Stephen Birikano agrees. He says FDC will struggle without four times presidential candidate Kanochiza Besigye, who recently announced will not contest again.
It is doubtful that they can have 2 million agents. Kanochiza Besigye was more loved as a person, like most other parties around. It's not really about the party, but as an individual. So, Amuriat having taken over from Besigye, the darling of many FDC supporters and other Ugandans, is trying to find footing.
Amuriat's team is headed by party chairman Ambassador Waswa Birigwa. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 20th. Cameroon-based education officials on the northern border with Nigeria say recent border attacks have made many schools there unsafe. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports.
Usmanu Garga, the Cameroon basic education official on the northern border with Nigeria, says several dozen schools in Cameroon's Mayo Sava, Mayo Chanaga, and Logon and Shari administrative units that border Nigeria's Borno State, the epicenter of Boko Haram, no longer function.
62 schools have been closed. The children have to either to be schoolized in older schools very far from their own villages or to abandon schools. 34,054 students have been registered as IDPs. We have the students of the host communities. We have even refugee students.
Garga said teachers in all the affected schools fled with the children they teach. Cameroon's military has been reporting at least 3 Boko Haram attacks every week since January. The military says most of the attackers are suicide bombers, mainly women and children. The military says the terrorist group has torched 13 schools within the past 2 months, held at least 200 people for ransom, and abducted an unknown number of civilians. Colonel Njikum Aze, commander of Cameroonian troops fighting Boko Haram in the Mayo Sava, Mayo Chanaga, and Logan and Shari administrative units, says the military has been deployed to protect civilians in the area. Aze says some troops have also been deployed to teach displaced students in safer areas less susceptible to Boko Haram attacks.
Ashigasha has for long been a target for Boko Haram assaults as early as 2014. The hierarchy thinks that to sustain a good security situation, it is through the youths, and the best process is their education.
Non-governmental organizations, rights, and humanitarian groups have been calling on Boko Haram to respect the Intergovernmental Safe School Declaration. Desiree Fuda of the NGO School First says the declaration should be observed to protect students and ensure they are able to obtain an education.
We sensitize different actors in education to respect those guidelines on safe school declaration so that all the different actors should contribute to help those children to have access to education.
Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting for 11 years to create an Islamic caliphate in northeast Nigeria. The fighting has spread to Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin, with regular killings, abductions, and burnings of mosques, churches, markets, and schools. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera says his government will establish a task force to deal with environmental issues affecting the country. He said Malawi was sadly losing an estimated 32,000 hectares of forest each year. Speaking Monday, the president also announced a national cleanup day. Sean Campudini is director of communications for President Chakwera.
President Chakwera had addressed the representatives of the Malawian people at Parliament on the 10th of September. And on that occasion, he had promised that in the near future, he would be delivering a national address to articulate his comprehensive agenda on the environment and climate change. And so today he delivered that address, and part of his address was the announcement of this national cleanup day that he would like to institute, where citizens across the country would take a moment to just go around their environment and to pick up any trash. It is his way of inculcating a culture of taking responsibility for trash and littering and being part of the solution to that rather than being part of the problem.
Sean, is this just symbolic because too often something like this is announced and then after one or two days or two times of doing it, there's no follow-up? Do you think the government is committed or the president is committed to it?
The president is so committed to it that he has announced that he himself is going to see to it that not only he but his entire administration leads by example to this. And in fact, he has called on the entire country to ready itself to participate in the same.
Too often, therefore, these environmental concerns sometimes come into conflict, say, with tradition or so. How committed is the president to the environment?
The president would agree with that assessment that there are often times when there is a conflict between cultural beliefs and traditional practices and what needs to be done in order to sustain the environment. And so the president, as part of his address, announced a robust program of engaging traditional leaders across the country, fronting the ones that lead by example in order to ensure that traditional leaders who are the fabric of Malawian society are fully engaged in the process of enlisting the entire citizenry in behavioral change as well as mindset change. The president today was flanked, as he delivered that address, by the Minister of Forestry and Natural Resources on his right and the Minister of Information on his left, because he fully expects that his cabinet will play a critical role in providing civic education to the country on these matters. And so the fact that today he set aside 2 hours in order to deliver an address exclusively on the environment and to answer questions not only from journalists in general, but from environmental journalists, in order for him to be fully, fully engaged in this process, I think is a demonstration of his commitment to the sustainability of the environment and addressing climate change issues.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's always nice to talk with you.
Welcome, James.
Sean Campudini is Director of Communications for Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Trees have the potential to generate income for rural populations, which are increasingly at risk of poverty during the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite the income benefits of saving forests, they are at increased risk of degradation, according to a new report by more than 20 leading forestry experts. One of those experts, Judith Kamoto from the Lilongwe University of Agriculture and Natural Resources, spoke to Ricky Stryak about Malawi's unique situation after decades of forest degradation due to tobacco farming.
We also have natural forests which occur on customary land. And this land is land under the jurisdiction of the traditional chiefs. Most of these forests under the customary land, they have been degraded. Why? Population growth. As the population has been growing, people have been expanding areas where to farm. So they expand where the forest is. Shifting cultivation. Why? Because in search of fertile soils. And also because, generally the population has been growing at a very fast rate lately. So people have to look for places where to settle, and they expand towards where the forest is. So most of these forests on customary land have been cut down.
How does destruction of these forests then, if it's being done for income-generating activities such as farming, actually contribute to increasing poverty? Because one might hear that and think, oh, but then they're using the land to make money.
Right. Yes, there has been deforestation because of expansion, because of farming. And the major crops in the central part of Malawi and northern part of Malawi has been tobacco. And most of this tobacco was flue-cured tobacco. So you have to use wood to cure the tobacco before you sell it. So in the mid-1990s, tobacco prices were really good on the market, and almost everybody was rushing into tobacco farming and cutting the forest. At micro level, the farmer would get a little bit of money. But over time, the prices of tobacco started going down, but the deforestation already took place. And the cycle of poverty, more or less, the clock has been rewinded back. So, yes, at that time, there was alleviation of poverty, but not completely moving people out of poverty. But the damage that was done to forests still remains.
What do you think decision makers should also get from this report?
I'm sure that this report is meant to inform policy. One of the key messages coming out of this is that forests play a very vital role in providing for rural livelihoods and supporting people come out of poverty. But what is needed is that we need to highlight the importance of forests to rural livelihoods and poverty alleviation, but we also need to highlight the need to conserve forests.
That was Judith Kamoto of the Lilongwe University of Agriculture and Natural Resources. She was speaking to Ricky Schreier from Lilongwe. And that's it for this Tuesday, October 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here. Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.